Hi, this is Cole Silver, and welcome to another edition of the Rain Dancing Expert Audio Series. Did you ever have an interest in competing with the big firms on an international basis? Do you really want to know what general counsels want? Well, our next guest can help. Daniel Hull, Esquire, founder of Hull McGuire PC, focuses on business law, commercial litigation, regulatory matters, and legislation. Since 1997, Dan has participated in conferences of the International Business Law Consortium in Europe and South America. He is a member of both the International Bar Association and the Congress of Fellows of the Center for International Studies in Salzburg, Austria. Dan's blog, What About Clients, has a worldwide audience, is about the art of making clients safe and happy. Dan will discuss how corporate boutique firms can court, service, and keep Fortune 500 clients. Welcome, Dan. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. So you have a small 12-person law firm with three offices around the country, and you do international work with Fortune 500 companies. How are you able to compete with the global mega firms of today?
Well, there's a few parts to that answer, but I think the first is that you have to have people who are working at your firm, your boutique, or cluster of boutiques who can literally work anywhere. Second, you have to pay them. Third, they have to be willing to do that kind of work. There are, as people in law firms who do corporate work know, enormous pressures on people who do high-end matters. So you need people who are not only able to do the work, but who are willing to put up with those kind of pressures. And we seem to have been able to find them over the last 15 years.
You know, before we started the interview, we were talking about, doing work abroad and how American law firms are expanding. Do foreign clients have any problem with the way we conduct the business of law, meaning hourly fees and, association with one partner and things like that?
When you said, I'm sorry, releases, I didn't really hear what you said.
Dealing with hourly fees, are international corporations used to paying for legal services in the same way American companies are?
I understand. I think that they're used to the same kind of fee structure, basically. I think the answer to that is yes. In fact, they might even be used to or expecting as high or higher fees from American firms as they would get from Magic Circle firms, say, in the United Kingdom. I think one thing that they might have trouble with and seem to be gun-shy about is getting involved in America in litigation in either the state or federal systems. So there seems to be a preference amongst especially the English and the Germans to be in some kind of mediation or arbitration if they can be.
Now, you know, Reed Smith and other big firms, when they go abroad, they usually acquire local firms. That would be expensive. So what are some of the joint strategic relationships that a small firm such as yours can form with these international firms?
Well, I think we had talked about that a little bit before the interview. And one thing you should realize, in the case of our firm, we're doing a couple of kinds of work. We're doing work that would normally be done in the United States or North America by much larger law firms. And then we're also doing work for American companies abroad. But in addition to that, there's a third part, and that would be doing work for primarily Western European outfits in the United States. One of the things we found was that a number of clients, starting with clients in the United States, came to us 10 years ago after they realized that we had formed helped form a worldwide consortium of people who wanted to do business together in a number of cities. And they asked us for, say, counsel in Eastern Europe or counsel in Rome. And when we asked them why they didn't use the firm that they were used to using, either out of a major American city or say, perhaps London, they said that, quite frankly, they didn't like the service. They didn't always like the branch office that had been acquired to make that firm bigger, and they didn't think the wiring was that good. Now, there are certainly exceptions to that, but there's certainly an inclination by the general counsel that we know to go off and find other boutiques like Hall McGuire in Europe, South America, and Asia, and work through them. In fact, my experience is that general counsel, good general counsel from good firms, if they can get a boutique or cluster of boutiques to work for them, they prefer it.
And why is that? Is it based on price or is it based on service?
Not based on price at all. In fact, I think most of the people that I work with may charge as much or maybe a little bit more than the larger firms. Certainly the people I know who set up boutiques did not do this to, you know, to get to become poor. Most of these people are, you know, straight-up capitalists. So the notion is that the work, which is just as good or better than the work that is done at a large firm, assuming you have those people, is done more attentively, more responsively, and in a little bit more nimble fashion. The client service is better. So they like the work better because it's as good or better, and the client service is much superior, and there's no reason they shouldn't pay more.
So let's talk about client service to Fortune 500 companies and general counsels in particular. How do you make a general counsel really happy?
General counsel are made really happy by doing any number of things or a combination of things over a period of years where they believe and know that you are worrying about them 24 hours a day. It's primarily based on trust, and that would be true with the smallest client or the largest. It's personal, and it really comes down to whether or not that client thinks that or GC thinks you have their best interest in mind. I think that general counsel who know that you want repeat work, and my firm is based on repeat work. In fact, we only look for a couple of new clients every year, maybe two or three, are more likely to believe or be inclined to believe that you are actually watching their costs for them. So we think of it as a partnering relationship in a non-hokey, non-Mr. Rogers way, where we really do go hand-in-hand on a day-to-day basis and work for them and try to expand the work we do.
You used the word personal in there, Dan. How personal is it? I mean, do you know their kids? Do you take them to golfing events? How personal does it get?
It depends. Any number of general counsel I know are very happy with us without my, like, getting to know the names of their kids and going to the Redskins games with them. Others like a little bit more contact. I think, by and large, though, what they're looking for is a good professional relationship with people that they like and trust and are 100% sure has their interest in mind at all times. And then there is a way to do that. You know, in client service in general, I thought I could have mentioned this in, it's not that Hall McGuire or some of the other boutique firms I know in the United States and in Europe are so good at it. It's just that everybody else is so mediocre to bad. And what we've tried to do with our blog and some of the other things we've written about client service is try to give people the idea that, one, client service isn't just important. It's very, very hard to do. And that if you think that you have a few standards and you talk about it a couple times a year, that that is going to be able to improve your services and keep clients coming back, you have another thing coming.
Why do you think other firms are so bad at it, and why do you describe really, really outstanding client service as hard?
Because I think for the most part that really, really good client service requires mixing in as seamless a way as possible the actual technical things you are doing on a brief, a transaction, an argument, a restructuring, a corporate tax deal, with actual response and a dialogue and communication with a client. And that's tough to do. Lots of firms say that they communicate with clients about things and they tell them what's happening. We don't think that's enough. We look at this as a social and fiduciary duty where at all times we should be telling the client anything they might want to know about. And one way we've been able to do that, which we think is very simple, is that for longer protracted transactions and also for pieces of litigation that go on for years and years in the federal courts or our arbitrations, we have weekly meetings and there is a call-in number for anybody on that team to the general counsel, which is usually Hall McGuire, possibly an expert, but always the general counsel and any other law firms on our side involved, where we discuss the matter, whether anything's happened or not. What we found is that it's not only a great way for the client to know that he's going to find out about what happened, if anything, in both slow and fast times. It's a great way for the people who are working on this thing together to sort of like catch up and say, oh yeah, we need to do this, we need to do that. That has been an enormous boon for us and our relationships with clients. Clients like it. And I really don't know, I know of only one other firm that does it, and I think they kind of got that idea from us. But that would be a good example of a thing you could do to actually make a client believe, and again, it's got to be true, that you are really concerned about their well-being and you're letting them know not only what's happening, but that you're kind of planning along the way the next step.
Dan, do you actually charge the client for these periodic updates, or is that off the hour role?
We might not, but generally those we charge for those. I mean, if you think about it, or maybe I should explain, the weekly meetings are primarily for faster projects.
Okay.
So if a faster project is going on, it would be something that would be likely billable. For clients where you're doing things, you know, from time to time on an ongoing basis, not a one-night stand, but not something every day, you wouldn't have those weekly meetings.
So you said that the threshold to provide good client service is pretty low because other firms are so bad at it. Why do you think that is? Is it not only because it's hard, but because maybe they were never trained or they don't have empathy, or why?
I really don't know. I'm just always amazed at how well lawyers do hard things, but how poorly they do simple things. And this is a people business, no matter how big your firm is. And you need to have people, even if they're not that good at it, to understand that everything they do, all the work they do, all the communications they have, including to a certain extent the communications they have with the people in their law firm, has something to do with, you know, the client, or sends some kind of message to the client that clients pick up on. I'm not sure why it's hard. I mean, I think personally it's hard to make sure that you do things that you said you're going to do, or make phone calls that you would like to make tonight rather than tomorrow morning. Practicing law is hard in general, but the client service part, it probably makes it even more difficult, but way more satisfying and way more lucrative in terms of clients coming back when you do it. There are a lot of things in our blog and website, specific ideas about how to serve clients. Everything from the kind of meeting I was talking to letting everybody know on one project, everybody, a team member in that project, knowing how much money the client has spent on it. Those kinds of things we find helpful. But
I think you hit it right on the head when you said that it's a people business. I think there are many lawyers who do not get that and see it as a technical business.
Well, in a little bit, that's probably okay. I mean, you want smart people with attention to details who are working in law firms. By the same token, law firms do not manage themselves well. That's almost a truism. Not everybody in a law firm is a great people person, and a lot of people in law firms don't really like to be around that many people all the time. They're somewhat introvertish by nature. We're not trying to teach everybody to be a marketer. We're just trying to teach everybody to have sort of a general counsel, if you will, or CFO consciousness about everything they do, so that they understand that they're not talking to themselves. This isn't academic. This isn't just something for them to do to make money or bill out hours for. This is something that people who have paid us money to do are concerned about, want a good result, you know, for. And have entrusted us. So, you know, we take it pretty seriously. I think we tend to over-communicate. And I can tell you right now, I've never had a client say, you're calling me too much, ever.
Well, or that you're not returning my call fast enough.
I don't think that's happened yet either. That would probably be the only way you could lose your job at Hall McGuire in the first week. If we instinctually didn't think you were good at that, you'd be out the door.
Do you, when you do hiring for your firm, do you say, okay, Joe is a technical expert and Sally's going to go out and get us business? Do you segregate it in that way?
We have, about half of us have there's a couple of marketing meetings every week, and they only can last for a half hour. And they're on Mondays and Fridays, and they're primarily geared toward making sure that our existing clients are happy and perhaps being able to get from the existing clients more work or different kinds of work. but they also have to do with a few new targeted clients, which are almost always publicly traded. So we study both their financials and their culture as if they were stocks. And we try to have five interviews or start a string of interviews with five different companies all over the United States every year.
How do you get your foot in the door with those companies?
Well, most of them seem to want to talk with us, and I'm not sure why. Maybe they just think that they got to meet the guy with the 12-man firm that wants to work for them all over the world. But we have people here who, whether they're natural marketing types or not, Julie McGuire is a good example. Tom Walshans is another, who are very, very good in their own way of communicating to a client that they care deeply about the work, and that we will do the work in the 10th year with the same kind of passion and care that we did it in the first week. You know, and it's funny. We're actually kind of a cynical, irreverent group of people, but we think the client service part about this is sacred. We think it's a privilege to work, and we think it's a privilege to practice law. We are concerned when we run into situations with other law firms. They can be big, they can be small, that have projects staffed, could be litigation transaction, where it's quite clear to us that not only are they not that interested in what they're doing, their client isn't too happy about the way they're doing it.
But you are going up against the other law firms who have, you know, deep practice areas, who can deal with requests for proposals, take the big Fortune 500's request for a reduction based on volume. How do you deal with that?
Well, first of all, we do give reductions for existing clients in particular. We do give reductions for volume, and we usually tend to go after volumes. We don't do requests for proposals because we think they're a waste of time. What we would do is get in and try to, say, do corporate tax work for a major Indianapolis company, for example, and then try to expand that into other areas. On depth, what I find is that for most litigation, not all, but probably 90% of it, you need no more than two senior lawyers and two not-so-senior lawyers, so four people. Two people kind of on top of all the time and to actually get the thing done from beginning to end, perhaps four. I see no cases, and I've been involved in primarily large pieces of litigation, where there are teams of primary people that are larger than that. So you can match the depth of a larger firm. You can charge the same rate. You can give better service. The only thing you can't do is you can't do as much of it for a group of clients as they can, because obviously they have more people. Another good way to get clients for us is, and it's the old, you know, 80-20 rule, whatever it is, we just really do try to minimize the need to get new clients by doing the best work possible for the clients that we have. And that seems to work, and that's fun. And if we find that we don't like working for a client anymore, it's changed, his culture's changed. We've had some very lucrative engagements over the last few years with both foreign and American companies where there was something about the GCs and the way the company was handling current problems or whatever it was that had nothing to do with us that just didn't make them fun to work for. We thought if they weren't fun to work for, that would probably affect our work. We thought we were growing, they weren't, we got rid of them.
Well, gee, that's a luxury that many law firms can't afford.
Not a luxury at all. If you don't like your client a lot and like working with them, you're not going to do a good job.
True. You talk about ease of use concepts on your blog.
Right.
Can you expand that idea a little bit?
Sure. I mean, I think one ease of use concept we already talked about, and that was the weekly phone call for protracted and ongoing matters. That is something that it's very simple and people have, you know, for some reason not instituted, but that really works. Another thing that is more indirect is that what we have done is made sure that a certain group of client service standards are incorporated into all the employee reviews. And that's a few people. If you take all the lawyers and the backup people, that can present quite a nice impression to clients if they know that their job performance is partly based on, or their job evaluations on how well they serve the clients.
And how do you relate? I was just going to ask you, how do you relay that to the client?
You just tell them. I mean, we've told them that before. We've told clients that you know, if there's anything about the service that they don't like, and that gets into another ease of use thing, polling, which a lot of people talk about, that they should tell us. Sometimes you're very surprised at who's doing great client service, who's not doing great client service. I don't hear very many criticisms about the substantive work. What you usually hear is what GC want to be is they want to feel safe and actually be safe substantively. So, you know, just technically isn't enough. They need to feel like they're sort of in good hands.
Talk to us about polling. Do you send a written survey? Do you go out and have lunch and say, how do we do? What can we do better? How do you poll?
That's a good question. What we have done, over the years, we decided primarily through some conversations with some other people who are doing what you're doing and blogging that we weren't doing our polling the right way. What we were doing was having either written evaluations or phone calls. We think that probably the best, and then we would follow it up with, after we did it, with you know, would you be willing to give us some more work or something like that in the most subtle way we could. We think that was the wrong way to do it. We think that somebody should sit down with them, if you can afford it, somebody not with the firm, certainly not somebody involved in the work that's being done, and ask them what they liked and what they didn't like and watch them and watch their expressions. And never in that meeting ask for more work. The purpose of it is how are we doing and how can we do it better. And we were just talking about that actually yesterday at my firm, and we're going to institute something more along those lines in the next couple of months because we think that's important.
Yeah, it really is powerful. I have done it for law firms, and Reed Smith has a full-time person that does it, and there is really nothing more powerful than having someone who's been on both sides of the aisle come to a general counsel or corporate client and say, you know, how did that transaction go? How did Jennifer handle this? What can we do better? I'm not here to ask for additional business. I'm just here to get feedback, similar to what Mayor Koch used to do, you know, walking around.
Exactly.
How am I doing?
Exactly. And how am I doing? I think, you know, it's a little bit like client service itself. You say, oh, that's a good idea. And then you start thinking, as we have over the last few months, how do you do that the right way? And how do you do it in a way that is not only helpful to the client but helpful to you? I mean,
absolutely.
You know, so that you can service the client better. So you're right about that, and we promise to get even better.
And, you know, I think the law firms that even take that one step further and go meet with clients who have terminated the relationship to find out why really, really exceed in customer service and learning about what they can do better and what they did wrong.
It sounds like a great idea. I hope I don't have to experience it.
Right. So, you know, you're a very unique guy with a unique firm and a unique spin on your blog. I'm going to ask you for your futuristic viewpoint of the boutique firm, the practice of law. Where is it going? Are we all going to be eaten up and merged into these big, colossal international firms? Where are we going?
Well, I think you're going in two directions at once, sort of up and down, if you will. And, you know, I'm speculating, but I think you're going to see much bigger firms, which I think is fine. I actually like big firms because I think they are enormously powerful for their resources and people. They're like a big library. I'd like my firm to be bigger. I don't need it to be 3,000, but I like big firms. And I'm more likely to refer something to a big firm than a boutique firm on certain matters. But I also think you're going to see boutiques and clusters of boutiques. And part of the reason for that is, some people in firms don't like being in the firms. I don't know why. I like being in a big firm. Some people don't like it. But others, some of us realize that you can make as much or more money in a boutique firm. So you saw, starting about 15, 20 years ago, firms primarily on the East and West Coast setting up groups of people in either boutiques or clusters. And by that I mean one I remember did something that was sort of manufacturing or plant-oriented by having – they just did employment environmental, which I thought was very interesting, and they're still around.
Hmm.
Or you could just be IT. In our case, we do four or five different kinds of things in which everybody in the firm has a stake in two of those practice areas, or those process areas, as we call litigation. So I think you're going to see very large, and I think you're going to see boutiques. And I think primarily the reason for that is the boutiques can take a lot of the work away from the medium-sized companies if they want it.
But I have to say it was an interesting comment that you said that when you do refer things out, you go to the big firms rather than to the boutiques.
Yeah, because I think there's more, frankly, I think there's more lawyers altogether in the big firms, than there, good lawyers, than there are in the boutiques. I think there's going to be more boutiques. Hmm. Boutiques is a relatively new thing. I think of them as muscle boutiques. And they can be, you know, different varieties of things. You can have, you know, like, as I said, one IP, a number of things, just litigation boutiques. But sure, big firm lawyers. I mean, I like big firms. I like big firm lawyers. I like that culture. I know it. But I think that more and more people are going to be forming boutiques, and they're going to be from large firms, and they're going to be doing it not because they want control necessarily or they want quality of life. It's because they can make money, and they figured out that there's a scale of things that can work for them. I also think that boutiques are going to do well in the future because general counsel has changed. General counsel has gotten way more sophisticated. Only a very insecure general counsel will not hire a boutique if it's good at what it does. Only a very insecure or unsavvy general counsel will always need to have like a firm name behind it. Also, technology has helped. Technology, which really blossomed after we started our firm, has helped us to work, you know, all over the world a little bit more easily. Although it does not make your client service better, it makes it easy to keep in touch with people. And the last thing, and since you asked the question, I think there's way more international networks than just mine. There's probably about 400 of them. And a lot of them are very stealth organizations with good business lawyers and firms, like in mine, between, say, 10 and 150 lawyers. And they're going to do well in competing with the Magic Circle firms and big New York and Chicago international firms.
With the world getting flat and law firms being run and looking more like businesses than ever before, what do you envision that to be like for the up-and-coming lawyer of today?
Well, people getting out of law school have some interesting choices to make right now. And to answer your question, I'm not sure where it's going. It is more like a business, which I think it makes it more uncomfortable for a lot of the personality types who would have liked it just sort of as a profession and sort of academic exercise and a white shoe thing, say, maybe 50 years ago. But in general, I think it means that the people getting out of law school are going to need to learn how to not just do, you know, the technical parts of their work, which are extraordinarily important to learn and difficult to learn, in addition to some kind of marketing or client service aspect. Everybody will need to be a marketer. When I was coming up through the ranks of being an associate, I actually know of an associate whose job was threatened because he tried to get a client. They didn't want him to get a client. They wanted him to work and do tax work. But now the situation is changing, and I'm not sure, but I do think that it requires younger lawyers to be both lawyers and salespeople, which is problematic. Lawyers aren't they're not good at business, and they're not good with people. There are exceptions, but this is not like a crowd-pleasing lot.
Well, on that note, Dan, how can people get a hold of you and your firm and your blog?
Well, if they're a general counsel, they can call me by going to hallmaguire.com and getting my phone number, or whataboutclients.com and getting a number there and calling either myself, Julie McGuire, or Al Sturdivant in Washington, D.C. If they're interested in talking about client service ideas, I'd be more than happy to talk with anybody about that.
Great. Well, Dan, thank you so much for being here today.
Cole, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This has been another edition of the Rain Dancing Expert Audio Series brought to you by Cole Silver of FindCareerSuccess.com. Until next time.